Chapter 2. A System of Suffering. By the mid-1960s, the American military had turned war-making into a thoroughly corporatized, quantitatively oriented system that the sociologist James William Gibson astutely calls techno-war. The philosophy behind it was simple. By combining American technological and economic prowess with sophisticated managerial capacities, the Pentagon meant to guarantee ultimate success on the battlefield. The country's unmatched military capability would allow it to impose its will anywhere in the world, with the war machine functioning as smoothly and predictably as an assembly line. This mindset was embodied most fully in the person of Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense from 1961 to 1968. As a Harvard Business School professor, McNamara had designed a statistical method of analysis for the War Department during World War II, most famously systematizing the flight patterns and improving the efficiency of the bombers that decimated German and Japanese cities. Before answering President John Kennedy's call to return to government service, he had spent the previous decade as a top executive of the Ford Motor Company. He brought to the Pentagon a corps of whiz kids and computer jockeys whose job was to transform the military establishment into a corporatized system that could, as the political commentator Tom Engelhart put it, be managed in the same scientific and efficient manner as a business. McNamara seemed almost to mimic the computers that he and his staff so fervently believed in. He relied on numbers to convey reality and, like a machine, processed whatever information he was given with exceptional speed, making instant choices and not worrying that such rapid-fire decision-making might lead to grave mistakes. There was to be no fog of war for his Pentagon. McNamara and his national security technocrats were sure that, given enough data, warfare could be made completely rational, comprehensible, and controllable. And they never looked back. In Vietnam, the statistically minded war managers focused, above all, on the notion of achieving a crossover point, the moment when American soldiers would be killing more enemies than their Vietnamese opponents could replace. After that, the Pentagon expected, the communist-led forces would naturally give up the fight. That would be the only rational thing to do. What McNamara and the Pentagon brass failed to grasp was that Vietnamese nationalists, who had long battled foreign invaders in pursuit of independence, might not view warfare as a straightforward exercise in benefit maximization to be pursued in a rational manner and abandoned when the ledger sheet showed more debits than credits. The crossover point, however, proved elusive. As years went by, the conflict only escalated. But though the Pentagon's expectations were not borne out on the battlefield, it failed to question the basic assumptions behind them. Instead, American officials launched study after study to further develop the principles of techno-war. Statistical analyses of enemy attacks, measurements of the security status of each and every South Vietnamese community, tabulations of enemy activity rates, and reams of other numbers poured out of the U.S. military in the field to be processed by the Pentagon. At the most basic level, though, everything came down to the body count, the preeminent statistic that served in those years as both the military's scorecard and its raison d'etre. How else could you tell if the crossover point was within reach unless you tallied the enemy dead? The war managers, of course, gave little thought to what this strategy, basing the entire American military effort on such an indicator as Vietnamese corpses, might mean for Vietnamese civilians. General William Westmoreland, who in 1964 took command of the U.S. military effort in the country, formerly known as Military Assistance Command Vietnam, or MACV, eventually attempted to distance himself and the Army from the term body count. In his post-war memoir, he claimed that in the early 1960s, before he arrived in Vietnam, the United States had been forced to add the phrase to its lexicon to appease the press's desire for accurate casualty statistics, but that he personally abhorred it. In reality, though, the body count concept had been employed as early as 1951 in the Korean War. There, too, KIAs, enemies killed in action, became the primary indicator of success. And as McNamara and other war managers demanded a statistic that would definitively demonstrate progress in the expanding war, body count would become, in the words of Assistant Secretary of Defense Alan Antoven, the measure of success. The pressure to produce high body counts flowed from the Pentagon to Westmoreland Saigon Villa, down through the chain of command, and out to the American patrols in the Vietnamese countryside. As Gibson notes, Producing a high body count was crucial for promotion in the officer corps. Many high-level officers established production quotas for their units and systems of debit and credit to calculate exactly how efficiently subordinate units and middle management personnel performed. Different formulas were used, but the commitment to war as a rational production process was common to all. As a result, low-level officers, who generally had 6 months in the field to prove themselves and earn a promotion, and the young combat troops they led were under constant pressure to produce enemy kills. The emphasis on body counts was everywhere. From the early 1960s through the early 1970s, from the Delta to the DMZ, soldiers and Marines experienced the same sort of pressures. The term body count kept popping up wherever officers talked to each other, Robert Peterson of the 25th Infantry Division remembered. It seemed that securing or pacifying an area was secondary to getting some kills. As Captain William Baker of the 4th Infantry Division recalled it, "Your success was measured by your body count. It came down through the channels." According to Ryan Causey of the 101st Airborne Division, it was all about body count. Our commanders just wanted body count. Gary Nordstrom, a combat medic with the 9th Infantry Division, remembered it as a constant drumbeat. Get the body count, get the body count, get the body count. It was prevalent everywhere. I think it was the mindset of the officer corps from the top down. Whether you achieved or exceeded what were essentially killing quotas had a significant impact on what your tour of duty in Vietnam would be like. Insufficient body counts translated into fewer comforts. They also meant less support in the form of airlifts, resulting in long, hot, dangerous hikes through treacherous terrain instead of helicopter rides to or from the base. Under pressure from commanders, low-level officers who hadn't met body count expectations would keep their troops in the field longer, courting exhaustion and shattered unit morale while exposing themselves and their men to a greater chance of death or injury. "I knew," said an officer from the 9th Infantry Division, "if I went in without a body count or at least a prisoner, I'd be on the shit list. So I kept the patrol out." While officers sought to please superiors and chased promotions, the grunts in the field also had a plethora of incentives to produce dead bodies. These ranged from R&R, rest and recreation passes, which might allow a soldier several days of fun in the sun at a beach resort, to medals, badges, extra food, extra beer, permission to wear non-regulation gear, and light duty at base camp. According to Wayne Smith, a medic with the 9th Infantry Division, the body count system led to a real incentivizing of death, and it just fucked with our value system. In our unit, guys who got confirmed kills would get a 3-day in-country R&R. Those guys got sent to the beach at Vung Tau. Another veteran echoed the same sentiments. They would set up competition. The company that came in with the biggest body count would be given in-country R&R or an extra case of beer. Now, if you're telling a 19-year-old kid it's okay to waste people and he'll be rewarded for it, what do you think that does to his psyche? As the war went on, some Americans racked up huge personal body counts, up to 1,000 or more for a select few who served numerous tours. Entire units were sometimes pitted against each other in body count competitions with prizes at stake. This helped make the body count mindset even more pervasive, lending death totals the air of sports statistics. Box scores came to be displayed all over Vietnam, on charts and chalkboards, also known as kill boards, at military bases, printed up in military publications, and painted as cross-hatched kills on the sides of helicopters, to name just a few of the most conspicuous examples. "We had charts in the mess hall that told what our body count was for the week," recalled one veteran. "So as you passed through the chow line, you were able to look up at a chart and see that we had killed so many." Competitions and command pressures quite naturally led to body count inflation. As Wayne Smith remembered, "If we came across 4 different body parts, we called in 4 kills." Yet, while overestimating or simply fabricating body counts has long been acknowledged within the military and by historians, much less recognized is a different type of body count padding, the inclusion of civilian dead. On September 1, 1969, for example, members of the 196th Infantry Brigade in Quang Tinh Province spotted a group of Vietnamese. Officers and sergeants, peering through binoculars, conferred about the situation. After about 10 minutes of observation, the senior officer, Captain David Janka, ordered his machine gunners to open fire and called in an artillery fire mission. A small patrol was then dispatched to the kill zone. Upon arrival, Assistant Machine Gunner Robert Gray said later, "We found dead and wounded Vietnamese children." Patrol member Welkie Louie described the scene. "I observed about 4 to 6 Vietnamese children lying in one pile, dead. About 5 meters from this position were 2 or 3 wounded Vietnamese children huddled together." Afterward, artillery forward observer Robert Wolves told Army investigators that he saw an official document in which the dead were listed as VC. Another report even referred to them as NVA, that is, North Vietnamese Army troops. In death, this small group of children had morphed into guerrillas and then into uniformed enemy soldiers as the body count wound its way through the military statistics generation machine. Sometimes, when units were short of kills, prisoners or detainees were simply murdered. On September 22, 1968, for example, members of the 82nd Airborne Division captured a wounded Vietnamese in Tua Tien province. "I got on the radio and told the CO, commanding officer, that the man was wounded, unarmed, and had surrendered," said Lieutenant Ralph Loomis. According to Loomis's testimony to an Army criminal investigator, his superior officer, Captain John Kapronopoulos, replied, "Damn it, I don't care about prisoners. I want a body count." Although Loomis ordered his men not to execute the prisoner, his radio man, Specialist Joseph Modigliano, opened up with a burst of automatic fire from his M16, killing the Vietnamese instantly. At roughly the same time, a second Vietnamese man, a civilian, was also detained. He had his hands tied behind his back and was forced to kneel. The unit's forward observer recalled that Sergeant Alexander Beard called the CPT, captain, on the horn and told him the man had no papers, and the CPT replied that the man was a gook or dink, and you know what to do with him. The group of GIs left the prisoner and walked away about 5 or 6 yards, and then I heard one weapon fire a burst, and I saw the prisoner fall. I then saw the group approach the dead prisoner, remove the rope from his arms, and roll him over into a ditch. Unit member Johnny Brinson told investigators that it had been a standing order for months not to take prisoners. Such cold-blooded killings went on in unit after unit, all for the sake of body count. The practice of counting all dead Vietnamese as enemy kills became so pervasive that one of the most common phrases of the war was, "If it's dead and Vietnamese, it's VC." In 1970, a candid internal report commissioned by the Army's acting general counsel addressed the question of whether the pressure for kills encouraged troops to inflate the count by violating established rules of engagement. The findings were damning. The report concluded that there was a certain inescapable logic to claims that emphasizing the body count led to violations of the laws of war. It is common knowledge that an officer's career can be made or destroyed in Vietnam. A command tour there is much sought after and generally comes only once to an individual who may have anywhere from 6 months to a year to prove himself in the crucible of combat. The pressure to excel is inevitably tremendous. A primary indication of such excellence has in the past been the unit's enemy body count. One reason for this has probably been the difficulty of developing other concrete indices. Under such circumstances, and especially if such incentives as stand-downs, R&R allocations, and decorations are tied to body count figures, the pressure to kill indiscriminately or at least report every Vietnamese casualty as an enemy casualty would seem to be practically irresistible. Sometimes there were even too many civilian corpses, leading to a different sort of statistical manipulation, body count deflation. After the My Lai massacre, the AmeriCal division claimed only 128 enemy dead, when in actuality more than 500 civilians had been slaughtered. At nearby My Khe, American troops massacred from 60 to 155 civilians, according to U.S. sources, but a body count of only 38 was reported to headquarters. Similarly, at the village of Truong Khan, where 63 civilians were massacred, only 13 of those bodies were counted as enemy KIAs due to combat action by ground troops, with another 18 reported as having been killed by subsequent airstrikes. And when Marines massacred 16 unarmed women and children at Son Thang, they were reported as a body count of 6 enemy kills. Soldiers realized that small groups of civilians could be killed with impunity and logged as enemy dead, but larger numbers might raise red flags if there were no U.S. casualties or few weapons captured. To avoid uncomfortable questions about skewed kills-to-weapons ratios, many patrols planted grenades, rifles, or other arms on dead civilians as a matter of standard operating procedure. They obtained these from weapons caches they discovered, or by taking arms from prisoners or enemy dead carrying more than one weapon, or sometimes even by repurposing U.S. weapons as enemy materiel. As one Marine explained, when civilians got killed, no problem. Just stick a CHICOM, Chinese Communist grenade on them, or an AK-47 assault rifle. They become VC. The dark humor in the opening stanzas of a song composed by soldiers from 1st Cavalry Division caught the anything-goes attitude perfectly. We shoot the sick, the young, the lame. We do our best to kill and maim, because the kills count all the same. Napalm sticks to kids. Oxcart rolling down the road, peasants with a heavy load. They're all VC when the bombs explode. Napalm sticks to kids. The piling up of Vietnamese bodies to be counted, and in a sense discounted, was facilitated by the contempt that Americans generally had for the country and its people. To President Johnson, Vietnam was a piddling pissant little country. To McNamara, a backward nation. President Nixon's National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger called North Vietnam a little fourth-rate power, later downgrading it to fifth-rate status. Such feelings permeated the chain of command, and they found even more colorful voice among those in the field, who regarded Vietnam as the outhouse of Asia, the garbage dump of civilization, the asshole of the world. A popular joke among GIs went, "What you do is, you load all the friendlies, South Vietnamese, onto ships and take them out to the South China Sea. Then you bomb the country flat. Then you sink the ships." Others swore that the best solution to the conflict was to pave the country over like a parking lot. An even simpler proposal was commonly offered: kill them all and let God sort them out. The deeply ingrained racism that helped turn the Vietnamese countryside into a charnel house was summed up in a single word, the ubiquitous gook. That epithet evidently entered the military vocabulary in an earlier conflict, the eerily similar campaign in the Philippines at the turn of the 20th century, where American troops began calling their indigenous enemies gugus. The pejorative term then seems to have transmuted into gook, and was applied over the decades to racially dissimilar enemies in Haiti, Nicaragua, and Korea before returning to Southeast Asia. From the beginning of the war to the end, it was uttered ad infinitum. The colonels called them gooks, the captain called them gooks, the staff all called them gooks. They were dinks, you know, subhuman, recalled one veteran. The notion that Vietnam's inhabitants were something less than human was often spoken of as the mere gook rule, or in the acronym MAD military, the MGR. This held that all Vietnamese, northern and southern, adults and children, armed enemy and innocent civilian, were little more than animals who could be killed or abused at will. The MGR enabled soldiers to abuse children for amusement. It allowed officers sitting in judgment at courts-martial to let off murderers with little or no punishment, and it paved the way for commanders to willfully ignore rampant abuses by their troops while racking up kills to win favor at the Pentagon. Even high-ranking officers who might never actually use the word gook in public operated in an MGR world. General Westmoreland told the filmmaker Peter Davis, "The Oriental doesn't put the same high price on life as does the Westerner. Life is plentiful. Life is cheap in the Orient. As the philosophy of the Orient expresses it, life is not important." And the dismissive mindset influenced military policy everywhere in the country. As the Vietnam War correspondent Frances Fitzgerald trenchantly noted in her classic book Fire in the Lake, the Americans' bombing and artillery practices would have been unthinkable for U.S. commanders in occupied France or Italy during the Second World War. The MGR mentality excused all manner of atrocities and encouraged troops to kill without compunction. "Shouldn't bother you at all, just some more dead gooks. The sooner they all die, the sooner we go back to the world," one Marine explained to another. In this way, the MGR provided lubrication for a system of suffering that, once set in motion, churned through the countryside without pause. At the top, pursuit of the crossover point demanded body counts. In the field, That meant Vietnamese KIAs, and the Mir Gook rule promised that any dead Vietnamese would do. In a conflict where American soldiers found it almost impossible to tell the enemy from the general population, the constant emphasis on body counts made civilian deaths almost inevitable. Specific command policies instituted in Vietnam, meanwhile, further ensured widespread slaughter. Chief among these were search-and-destroy tactics, loophole-laced rules of engagement, and free-fire zones. The primary mission of U.S. troops sent out into the jungles, rice paddies, valleys, and villages of South Vietnam was to search out and destroy the revolutionaries. This was how Westmoreland saw the war, and at his behest, members of his staff gave the search-and-destroy mission its name. These operations consisted of near-ceaseless patrols by small units meant to find, fix, and finish enemy troops. In other words, their role was to draw or flush an enemy unit out of hiding in the countryside and hold it in place while more U.S. forces were called in, generating the sort of big battles in which air power and heavy artillery would make all the difference. By June 1967, U.S. battalions were spending 86% of their time on such operations. Search and destroy was more a gestalt than a tactic, brought up alive and steaming from the command psyche, wrote the combat correspondent Michael Herr in his fever dream war memoir, Dispatches. In action, it should have been named the other way around. Pick through the pieces and see if you could work together a body count. There was something absurd about the entire enterprise. Day after day, patrol after patrol, U.S. troops wandered around the countryside, spoiling for a fight, trying to goad a lightly armed enemy to abandon all sense and stand toe-to-toe in open battle with the best-armed military in the world. U.S. troops were to be used as the principal combat reconnaissance force and supporting fires as the principal destructive force, wrote Colonel Sidney Berry in a widely disseminated 1967 essay on the tactic. That is, the American boys on patrol were just a lure, dangling the bait, as the veteran and future Senator James Webb put it in his Vietnam War novel, Fields of Fire. When attacked, they were supposed to back away and call in heavy firepower to destroy their Vietnamese foes. It sounded easy enough and looked good on paper, but in the field, search and destroy proved to be a wholly defective tactic. Vietnamese forces refused to do battle as Americans wished them to, declining to take the lure and fight at the time and place of the U.S. military's choosing. Tipped off by preparatory artillery, roaring helicopters, and repetitively predictable patrolling patterns, the revolutionary forces generally refrained from large set-piece combat engagements where the odds would be greatly against them. Indeed, search and destroy gave Vietnamese revolutionary forces an overwhelming tactical advantage. They could take the bait whenever and wherever it suited them, which meant that no matter how aggressive the patrols were, the Americans almost invariably found themselves on the defensive. According to the Pentagon Papers, the Viet Cong surprised U.S. forces, dictating the time, the place, and often the duration of combat engagements, more than 78% of the time. Another report showed that the revolutionary forces began 73% of all firefights. Unable to effectively engage the enemy, U.S. soldiers sometimes took to attacking whatever they could, which often meant that civilians ended up paying the heaviest price. Looking back, Westmoreland later claimed that many Americans apparently failed to comprehend search and destroy. It was, he insisted, anything but a brutal policy of aimless searches in the jungle and the random destroying of villages. His troops, however, provided a far more accurate description of the tactic than their base-bound commander. To infantrymen and field marines, the phrase search and destroy was shorthand for systematic destruction of hamlets and sometimes of everyone in them. It was a search-and-destroy mission, one officer with the 4th Infantry Division recalled, which meant we searched all the hooches we found and then burned them down. Whether a single farmer's hooch or a whole village, all were burnt. A rifleman questioned about the massacre by his unit explained how the term was generally understood by troops in the field. Question: what about this operation? Were you told anything? Were you given any special instructions? Answer: destroy everything. Question: destroy it all? Village, livestock, and food stocks? Answer: witness nods in the affirmative. That's what a search and destroy is, isn't it? That soldier testified that his commander didn't explicitly order his troops to kill all the people in the village, But when the men were ordered to carry out a search-and-destroy operation, the implication was that anything there was VC, and to do away with it. Another veteran had a similar assessment. The search-and-destroy mission is just another way to shoot anything that moves. Westmoreland's idealized version of search-and-destroy operations was typical of the way that policies on paper diverged radically from the reality of the war. For instance, the U.S. command usually issued specific rules of engagement, ROE, that detailed when, where, and under what circumstances personnel could bomb, shell, or use helicopters or ground forces to attack. Ostensibly, the ROE protected non-combatants by providing clear guidance on who could be killed and why. Telford Taylor, chief prosecutor at the Nuremberg trials of Nazi war criminals, found these rules on their face virtually impeccable. In practice, though, the ROE constantly put Vietnamese civilians in impossible predicaments. Rules on which villages could be attacked and when, for example, were predicated on a fantasy belief that civilians had the ability to evict armed guerrillas. Sometimes attacks were justified by months-old announcements stating that locals had to either force out guerrillas or abandon their land. If villagers failed to heed such warnings, it was their fault in the eyes of the Americans. They had made themselves legitimate targets. Instead of providing genuine protection, the ROE often served as an exculpatory device. For example, when it came to a target that involves non-combatants, such as in a hamlet or village, a South Vietnamese observer, often termed a backseat, had to give approval for an airstrike whenever possible. The idea, as the reporter Jonathan Schell explained, was that the province chief, or district chief, as a Vietnamese, is presumed to be more familiar with the surroundings than the Americans and able to restrain them from destroying populated areas. After seeing the process in action, though, Schell noted that in the case of Binh Duong province in January 1967, the province chief was from outside the province, had taken his post only 3 months before, and had never controlled most of the areas being bombed, so he knew less about the area than most of the Americans. Generally, the Vietnamese observers just gave U.S. forces blanket authority to do as they wished, and when they didn't, the Vietnamese were often simply ignored. As one American province senior advisor blandly noted following an incident in which U.S. helicopters killed some unarmed people, the gunship pilots were overeager and did not follow the instructions of the Vinh Binh backseat. Behind the scenes, commanders recognized that wanton attacks, prohibited under an honest interpretation of the ROE, were a regular occurrence. In a confidential 1967 message to his top Marine Corps generals, Lieutenant General Robert Cushman wrote, "To answer sniper fire from a hamlet or village with mortars, artillery, or 90-millimeter gunfire will kill or injure more non-combatants than it will snipers. The rules of engagement are clear, but they are not always followed." After the war, in a survey of generals who commanded troops in Vietnam, only 19% said that the rules of engagement were carefully adhered to throughout the chain of command before the My Lai massacre became public knowledge, while 15% admitted that the ROE weren't even particularly considered in the day-to-day conduct of the war. The true purpose of the various directives, regulations, and pocket-sized codes of conduct handed out to troops was not to implement genuine safeguards for non-combatants, but to give the military a paper trail of plausible deniability. At every turn, the onus was put on Vietnamese civilians to actively demonstrate that they were indeed non-combatants by carrying identification cards certifying their loyalty to the Saigon government, by staying out of off-limits areas, the borders of which they might not know, by adhering to dusk-to-dawn curfews, by using no lights at night, which might signal guerrillas, or sometimes by displaying lights at night to demonstrate that they were not hiding, by not running or not walking in a certain way, or not standing still and thus looking unnatural, by somehow forcing armed guerrillas from their villages but also not carrying weapons, which would automatically brand a Vietnamese as VC. If villagers did not know about any one of these or many other regulations, if an ID card was lost when a house went up in flames, if they had to leave before dawn to get to a far-off market or to make it to a rice field, if they were forced by hunger to forage in an off-limits area, it was their fault. The claim that civilians broke the rules, the historian Christian Appy notes, gave the American military a legal-sounding justification for both accidental and intentional slaughter. Over and over again, the killings of civilians were excused by citing such capricious, even contradictory, rules. In March 1969, for example, helicopters from the 1st Cavalry Division spotted a group of 9 woodcutters and their truck in a forest in Binh Long Province and hovered above them for 10 minutes as the Americans grew increasingly agitated that the Vietnamese would not look up or acknowledge them. There was ample reason for such behavior, as Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Herbert would recall in his memoir. Vietnamese, going about their daily work, he pointed out, knew not to look up. By then it had become almost instinct. Each had probably known someone who had looked up who was now dead. I had actually read it in one of our so-called manuals. When they look up, they're VC. Stupid, but typical. Eventually, one of the helicopter pilots ordered his door gunner to drop canisters of tear gas, one of which soon started a fire near the woodcutter's truck. With tear gas in the air and a fire raging, some of the woodcutters began to run, while one jumped into the truck and tried to drive it into a nearby clearing. In response, an order was issued in the chopper above. "They're bad guys. Roll in and get them." Rockets streamed down, blasting the truck, while machine gun fire ripped through the area. Only one of the woodcutters survived the attack. An investigation of the incident revealed that all the dead were civilians. 3 bodies were eventually identified as those of a middle-aged man, a woman, and a young boy. The others were too badly disfigured for identification. In interviews with Army agents, the helicopter crew members readily admitted that they had not received gunfire from the woodcutters and that the Vietnamese had exhibited no hostile behavior. Furthermore, investigators found no enemy shell casings or weapons at the site. Yet none of the troops were punished. According to the official inquiry, they had fired in good faith, convinced that they were engaging a hostile force, which under the ROE automatically made their action legal. A lack of effective rules of engagement, plus command-level failure to take action against obvious breaches, meant that when hard decisions had to be made in the field, troops often chose their own safety over that of the civilians they had supposedly been sent to protect. For example, guerrillas might open fire from concealment and then dash into a nearby village for cover. A young U.S. officer, adrenaline coursing, thankful for a near miss or upset and enraged over a man down, now had a choice to make. He could let the guerrillas go and explain to his superior why he had no body count to report, or he could lead his young, angry, scared troops into a possibly booby-trapped village to face another attack. There was, however, a third option. Disregarding or bending the ROE, he could ring up a rear base and call in artillery, jets, or helicopter gunships, perhaps saving the lives and limbs of his troopers and getting some bodies to count, which would please command and get them off his back. The third choice, of course, was usually the easiest to justify for a 20-something lieutenant looking to survive his 6 months of trigger time and keep his group of boys alive. Hard choices became progressively easier with repetition, in part because it was soon apparent to many young officers that few at headquarters knew or cared much about the details in the field, beyond the stats, that is. Commanders regularly seemed disconnected and indifferent. It was easy enough for them to order a patrol out on a search-and-destroy mission. It was a lot harder for those on patrol to trudge mile after mile across sweltering jungles and rice paddies, through thorny hedgerows or razor-sharp elephant grass standing 6 feet high, up and down highland hills and valleys, all simply to serve as bait for enemy guerrillas. Generals and colonels weren't out in the field, dirty, hungry, and dehydrated, slogging through mud, muck, and water, each step an ordeal, day after day, sometimes for weeks on end, until their feet swelled and the skin painfully sloughed off in silver dollar-sized chunks. The commanders didn't come down with constant bacterial infections, suffer oozing sores, crotch rot, and other fungal infections. They didn't have to burn off leeches and face heat exhaustion while being bitten by fire ants and eaten alive by mosquitoes. They sat back at the base and soared high above it all in helicopters, micromanaging from the sky. Who were they to prescribe rules about firing on villages? Who were they to demand additional risks from troops who had it tough enough as it was? After all, a young lieutenant or captain had to ask himself, didn't artillery fire already blanket the countryside? When choppering out to a landing zone to begin a patrol, he couldn't fail to notice field after field of craters and the endless burned-out villages. The artillerymen and the jet pilots, who never had to worry about tripping a booby trap or walking into a hostile village, seemingly had carte blanche to shell and bomb with impunity and were never investigated for violating the ROE. Given all this, was a young officer prepared to have his point man get hit and listen to him scream for help while enemy fire pinned the patrol in place and the medic tried to crawl out to save him? Or was he going to call in a fire mission on the village, no questions asked? Even if some REMF, rear echelon motherfucker, at base did bring up the rules of engagement and note that the grid square to be targeted came up as a populated area on the map, all that the officer needed to do was declare contact, that is, enemy fire, to override it. So what if the guerrillas' attack had stopped? So what if they might have long since escaped? Was it worth the lives of his men to take the risk for rules that were written up in some air-conditioned office in Saigon or Washington?